You're listening to Sound Effect from KPLU. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and this is the kind of letter that Pamela Weibel gets.
Dear Pamela, an anatomy professor did in fact inform us that we would commit suicide at a higher than average rate and informed us from the lectern how to accomplish it successfully. Considered following the instructions on three occasions, most recently when a four-year-old I had in the hospital died.
Okay, so this is a letter from a fellow doctor, a doctor who's grappling with thoughts of suicide. Physicians are in the business of saving lives, but they have one of the highest suicide rates of any profession. An estimated 400 doctors a year take their own lives. Pamela Weibel is a physician in Eugene, Oregon, and she's devoted a big part of her career to helping doctors cope with thoughts of suicide. As you can probably tell, this is a tough subject that's not going to be appropriate for all listeners, and this interview in particular gets pretty heavy. It's about 10 minutes long. When I talked with Weibel, she told me about the moment she realized how big a problem physician suicide is.
I was sitting at the memorial service for the third physician that we lost in our small town in just over a year. And I sat there in the second row of his memorial service, and I just started counting the suspicious deaths of doctors. And I realized I had quite a number of them, including both men that I dated in medical school.
What is it about the profession that makes suicide a particular risk?
Well, we have kind of an antiquated medical education model that's based on the kind of, I would say, tough it up, suck it up, you know, don't cry, feelings aren't welcome here, do your job, do it efficiently, almost like kind of a militaristic model of medical training. And that's very dehumanizing to the students. And a lot of medical students actually graduate with PTSD. So it's a traumatic educational process. And I think that's the root cause of much of this.
Oh, that's interesting. So it's really about the paradigm that's kind of drummed into them in med school and in training?
Right, because when you compare the mental health of medical students at the beginning of training, they come in with their mental health on par with or greater than their peers. And something happens during medical training that disables them, essentially.
Can you think of an example from your own training that demonstrates that, a way in which you feel like it dehumanized?
Well, besides the obvious sleep deprivation and the massive amount of material that we're supposed to learn, in my particular program, we had to do dog labs, which meant that every four students were assigned to one dog that used to be a pet, and we were supposed to kill it, to learn very simple physiologic techniques that could be learned in other ways. And this is absolutely a dehumanizing process that I protested and was able to get exempted from. And in fact, they didn't even refer to this as an experiment. The physiology professor referred to this as an experience in which there was no alternative. And they actually made fun of me. The dean told me I had Bambi syndrome.
Do doctors get care when they need it? I mean, mental health care. I mean, considering that doctors are dispensing care and counseling patients all the time, you'd think they would know exactly what they need and how to get it.
No, absolutely not. In fact, we're not allowed to seek mental health care for fear of losing our license. On our licensing applications, there is a question that is actually in the same area as the questions about criminality and DUIs and felonies. In there, in that section, there's a question about if you've ever sought mental health care. And if you check yes, you will have to probably meet with the board in person to describe why you did that. And I've known a physician in town, actually in Oregon, who was delayed in getting her license by 6 months because she checked that box, being completely honest. And why she checked it is she sought counseling during a divorce. You know, everyone is depressed during a divorce. She had to pull her records, which that counselor had since retired. They made her go get evaluated by another counselor for her mental health before they would allow her an Oregon medical license.
So that has a chilling effect, huh? I mean, how do people...
It has a chilling effect because, you know, honestly, I have a friend who's a psychiatrist. She's an excellent psychiatrist, and she actually drives 200 miles out of town, uses a fake name, and pays cash to get mental health care.
Oh, wow.
How would you like that? In order to be off the grid and not be tracked by the medical boards. The other thing is I hear from medical students and physicians all the time that they actually are jealous of their dying patients in hospice, and they could wish they would, you know, jump in bed and be the one with cancer so they could get some downtime and some rest.
That is so shocking. And it's so different than the lay public perception of doctors, that doctors are either heroic, mission-driven, you know, saintly people, or, you know, that doctors are business people or whatever. I mean, what you're describing is really alien to folks who aren't close to the profession, I think.
Physicians are not allowed to really be vulnerable and to share what's really going on. So they put on the white starched coat and smile and have their bow tie, and nobody really knows, you know, what's going on under that coat.
So you have chosen to tackle this in some very particular ways, including these retreats that you bring healthcare professionals on. Can you talk about those? Like what happens on them?
These whole things began as just business strategy retreats to try to help physicians who want to open independent practices. But interestingly, on that day that I went to this gentleman's memorial, that evening I had a retreat and I showed up, and I had fallen into this physician suicide topic in such a bizarre way. I just thought I would check in with the people attending the retreat. And I opened the retreat by asking, how many of you have lost a colleague to suicide? And everyone's hand was raised. And then I asked, well, how many of you have considered suicide? And every single hand remained up, including mine, except for the one female nurse practitioner.
Did that change the nature of those retreats then?
Well, I started to realize that a lot of people came to the retreats for emotional healing, and that that really was in the way of them starting their independent practices. The emotional healing is required before we can really be the doctors that we dreamed of being.
So when you're together in those settings, how do you set about trying to help people?
Well, I think a lot of it is just having these healers off the grid. There's no cell phone, no internet service. I've got 40 to 50 doctors in a lodge room on 150 acres in the mountains of Oregon, and they literally are just finally willing to tell the truth about their experience in medicine. And so there's a lot of crying, there's a lot of hugging, there's a lot of validation. And I think people for the first time feel that they're not defective. The system is defective and they've been abused. The other thing that's so beautiful is actually, because we were wounded collectively, I do feel like the treatment for physicians is collective, meaning pulling off the weak ones, quote unquote, on the periphery and throwing them into a psychiatrist's office isn't the best way to deal with our collective wounds. So I think when you can get healers together, they naturally heal one another. It's a really beautiful thing to witness.
So you said that when you asked that question about how many people in the room had considered suicide and everyone's hand went up, including yours, what do you want to say about your own struggles with suicidal thoughts?
I want to say that I came into medicine, like most people, as an idealistic humanitarian that just wanted to help people. And the reason why I developed these suicidal thoughts, I mean, I did get into some major depression during my first year of medical school, completely related to those dog labs and watching the dehumanization process of my classmates, which was just brutal. But then once I got into medicine, you know, you're always thinking it's going to be better on the other side. Wait till you graduate. But I was pretty much like everyone else in the country, funneled into these assembly line medical jobs, which are not the definition of healing. 7-minute office visits where you're just feeling like you smack Band-Aids on people is not at all healthcare. And so I got depressed and suicidal because I felt like I cannot believe I invested 24 years of education, all this time and energy into a profession that I love. And when you're stuck in a system that does not allow you to be a healer, it's an absolute assault on your soul. And so that's where I was, the dark night of the soul.
What helped you emerge from that?
I had an epiphany that if the patients are miserable and I'm miserable, I'm looking at my colleagues and they look miserable even though they're, you know, faking it sometimes and putting on these smiles. I just decided, you know what, I'm going to turn this over to my community. I'm going to lead a town hall meeting and I'm going to ask the end user, the patient, to design their ideal practice, to write my job description, and I'm going to work for them. And I've been so happy doing this now for 10 years. And what I call an ideal medical clinic designed by the patient.
Do you see any signs that this is getting any better? Is the training?
Yes, definitely, because we're talking about it. And I think the fear of speaking about the trauma that we experience as medical students and physicians is dissipating so that we're more able to have this open and with the internet, you know, kind of conversation. And the fact that we're no longer hiding all these bodies and hiding all the data is the big first step. I mean, if you think about it, you know, to use a medical analogy, there's no way you're going to solve somebody's medical problem until you have the correct diagnosis. Where would we be if we were afraid to say Ebola out loud or HIV? We would be nowhere. And so we've got to be able to say physician suicide out loud. And the next question after people recognize that this is a crisis is why? And when people start asking why, then we start solving it.
Well, Dr. Pamela Weibel is a family physician in Eugene, Oregon, and she joined us from there, from the studios of KLCC. She works with doctors in the Northwest and all over the place on suicide prevention. Thank you so much for being on Sound Effect.
Yeah, thank you.